Welcome to Local Share Green Action Podcast. This show is produced by Go Green Locally, a 501c3 nonprofit providing tools and resources for people that are looking for ways to take even more successful local action that makes a difference for our people and our planet. Welcome back to our podcast. Today, I'm excited to reconnect with the visionary behind a nonprofit initiative dedicated to cultivating and distributing free native trees for reforestation efforts across urban, suburban, and landscapes. Moreover, he's the author of a new inspiring book titled From Wasteland to Wonder: Simple Strategies for Healing the Earth in Urban and Suburban Spaces. I'm speaking with Basil Camus from Leaf and Limb, a tree service company, and a nonprofit called Project Pando, both located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Basil loves all things of natural ecosystems, from trees to soil, wildflowers, insects, bats, and fungi. He's a treecologist, ISA board certified master arborist, and Duke graduate. And he is committed to taking action that helps care for and restore the planet. Though trees are his passion and profession, he also loves cultivating flowers in his garden, restoring native meadows, and propagating plants from seed. On the personal side, he's a family man who enjoys hanging out with his wife and sons, doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, powerlifting, hiking, long-distance running, and whenever possible, world traveling. So welcome back to the show, Basil.
Thanks for having me. It's really great to be back.
I'm so excited to speak with you again and catch up on what you've been doing and learn about your new book.
Yeah. Well, since the last time we spoke, we've been continuing our work with Project Pando. And a really big part of our early days were we wanted to build the model. So we've probably spent a good full 3 years just experimenting with different methodologies, how to grow seeds. What's the easiest way to produce substrate for the boxes where we grow our seeds? How best to collect seeds from community volunteers? There's just so many things that we needed to figure out and we needed to iterate and get it right. And then we spent the next several years working on getting all of that in writing. And that was great because it dovetailed into sort of what was a passion project for me. I started doing a presentation. This is via Leaf and Limb now. So I sort of wear two hats, the for-profit purpose-driven Leaf and Limb, and then the nonprofit Project Pando. So on the Leaf and Limb side, back in 2020, I had started doing a project called How Trees Can Save the World and What We Can Do to Help. And it was a really well-received presentation. I was just actually quite surprised at how well received it was. And I started getting a lot of requests and a lot of conferences and different things. And I really just didn't have the time to do that. So I decided instead just to turn it into a book. And it became this side hobby of mine that spanned 4+ years or thereabouts. And that's what turned into this book, From Wasteland to Wonder: Easy Ways We Can Help Heal Earth. And that's the whole premise of this book, is it's working with trees, it's working with soil, it's working with flowers, and it's attempting to give readers these easy strategies on the ways they can save time and save money and actually do good for the well-being of Earth. And that's sort of the crux of it, but bringing this story full circle, the entire fifth section of the book is designated to the Project Pando model. So we've got the full model laid out. It also, just everything we've learned, basically. I shouldn't say everything. There is, we want to keep it simple. We give readers an option to access our databases of more complicated information. So we don't include that in the book. But essentially, the reader can learn the basics and then learn more if they want to from there. So that's very exciting. It's great to have the Project Pando model in paper or on paper. And we're excited that other people can start doing this in their communities.
Great. Great. And so who do you envision using this book?
So the book is ultimately a little background about Leaf and Limb. We're obviously working with a lot of homeowners and HOAs and commercial spaces. So these are the sorts of people we talk to every day. Some of our client base are gardeners, and some of our client base are ecological do-gooders and love the sort of things that you and I love. But I would say many folks that we help, they generally want to do good and they want to do healthy things in their yard, but they don't necessarily know what that looks like. And they don't have time to learn these things, especially gardening. It's a big endeavor, especially native gardening. And they don't have the money to hire the designers who know plants and native plants really well and can build an ecologically sound yard for them. So they're sort of stuck at the bottom of the status quo, which is just do it like it's been done, you know, hire the lawn care company to keep doing the lawn care regimens that cause so many issues. I mean, lawns are an ecological disaster, full stop. But the thing is what do you do if if you don't have money or time to learn another way? So this book aims at those people. It teaches them, you know, again, it's through the vein of trees, getting rid of grass by planting native flowers, saving all your green waste, this is carbon, building diverse ecosystems. We can get into more details about the actual book, but the person I'm speaking to is that segment. It's sort of the typical suburbanite who doesn't have the time or money to learn gardening or hire a designer.
Right. So can you talk about the section of your book where you discussed wolves as a keystone species and their reaction to Yellowstone, and maybe some of the ways that that had kind of a cascading effect that we will be familiar with?
Absolutely. So the first two sections of the book are these a grand total of 8 short, fun essays. And 4 of them are about how these big natural systems work, photosynthesis, soil. And then the next 4 are about essentially how we've destroyed those systems. And that sets the groundwork for why I've suggested the things I suggest later in the book. Everything flows through this vein. So when we're talking about, so in the first section, it's first talking about trees and flowers and grasses, then talking about soil formation. And then we get to life, biodiversity, some would say. And then so talk about how life plays this really important role in holding carbon and just making the world the beautiful place it is. So when I get over to section 2, I go back to these same topics and explain how we're destroying these systems. And I talk specifically about how we hunted wolves to near extinction here in North America. There's several case studies I use. And I think what's so fascinating about the wolves is that we also are getting to see the reverse in action. So in Yellowstone, over the past several decades, they have been reintroducing the wolf and they've been watching what takes place. And it's absolutely profound. It's this unimaginable, you know, we talk about first order, second order, and third order effects. I mean, this cascading sequence has, I don't know how many orders of effects. I mean, just to give you some examples, as the wolf began to establish and began hunting the caribou, they found that now these specific types of trees that the caribou loved were finally able to grow properly because they weren't being overeaten. And as those grew, then it provided the necessary type of wood for beavers who were able to now harvest the wood and build the dams, which slowed the water down. And when the water slowed down, it had all these effects with what was able to grow near the stream beds, which brought in the bears and this story just goes deeper and deeper. It's just really incredible. And I love it. And I think what that illustrates is several things. One, you know, it depends on who the reader is. If you care about life purely just because life matters, and it does, then the story is beautiful because so much life returns to this space. If you care about these environmental issues from a carbon lens, and there are many people, that's their lens, and that's great. Whatever gets you to the table, that's fine. If you care about the carbon lens, it's also a useful case study because it shows how letting ecosystems restore can hold so much carbon. It's just incredible. All life is built on carbon. So as populations of life are exploding and trees are growing, this is carbon being pulled from the atmosphere. If you're in that part of the country, you probably worry a lot about water security. We're seeing really big issues in California. Well, one of the reasons we have water security issues is because we've destroyed soil across the planet. So This case study is also great news to those folks because it shows that when you let ecosystems restore, part of what that means is water begins to soak down instead of run off. And soaking down versus running off, that's the difference between refilling aquifers and not. So there's just lots of ways to love the story. And that's why I featured it.
Yeah, excellent. Can you talk a little bit about how Project Pando, well, let's just do a quick little overview of Project Pando and how that works, and then maybe explaining a little bit about how Project Pando infuses more genetic variation into the landscape, and it's differing from, let's say, if we go do a bulk purchase from a local nursery of certain trees. So maybe.
Yeah, we'll get into a little bit of that. There's so much to talk about with Pando, but in short, what we do at Project Pando is we work with the community and we gather seeds from native trees and shrubs here locally. And we grow those seeds in what are called air pruning beds. It's a very simple, easy thing to make. And the advantage with these air pruning beds is we can grow a lot of trees in a very small space. And as those seeds develop roots, they push down to the bottom of the bed and they touch, and then it becomes air. So the reason it's called the air pruning bed. And that has the effect of telling the plant to stop growing down and start growing sideways, its root system rather. And that ends up, this is a long technical way of saying, you get these saplings with absolutely gorgeous root systems. Once those saplings grow up, we give them away for free. We do tree giveaways to the public, but we really work a lot with ecological restoration projects here locally, nonprofits doing projects, municipalities. So we're able to funnel these. Just recently, we were able to work with North Carolina Wildlife Federation on a big creek restoration. So this is great for these organizations because they can get free plant material from us. And as a nonprofit, resources are always limited. So not having to pay for trees for a creek restoration or for a street tree planting is really potentially the difference between that project happening or not. So what we're getting at with this Project Pando is first and foremost, it's meant to reconnect people and trees. We want to foster that relationship. We think, sort of the biggest problem we have right now is the fact that people are just so separate from, I'll say nature. I use that term loosely because I don't even like the idea of sort of referring to nature as something else. But, what people would refer to as nature, we've lost that connection. So our biggest, if we could reestablish that connection, I think it would change how people vote and spend their money, might change policy, who knows. Sort of at a secondary level, we want to make native trees much more easily available. They do grow, you literally grow on trees. As long as you know a few things, you can grow them. And you can grow in a very small space, 8 square feet. You can grow 300 oak trees. That's a lot of young, healthy oaks. And then in terms of sort of genetic diversity, the other nice thing about this is that these trees come from local wild, these seeds come from local wild trees. So we're getting that genetic diversity that happens out in the forest. If you buy a nursery tree, you're getting a clone. Most things sold at a nursery are clones of another plant. And that's sort of because there are trademarks and that's how people make money on certain plants is through the production of the trademark. So if it's a cultivar, you'll go and see some specific type of, pick a plant. It'll have a very specific name. Those are called cultivars. That means there's a trademark. That means the growers are using clones because that's how it has to work. So when those trees go into the suburban landscape, they are genetically identical. We have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of autumn blaze red maples here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And that is a specific cultivar. They're all genetically identical. If something were to happen, they would all be impacted because they're the same.
Yeah, I think a good example of that would be the American chestnut was pretty devastating to lose so many, but there was a few holdouts in key places where you know, they did survive because they maybe had a little bit of genetic variation. So, yeah.
Yeah, now the American chestnut story is an interesting one too. And I feature that in the book as well. What we're talking about with that is actually an invasive pest. So the American chestnut had never encountered this very specific fungi that came from Asia. They actually brought it over on an Asian chestnut variety. And when they brought it over, the tree was unable to withstand that attack because they had not co-evolved with each other. So that strain that the Asian variety was able to keep at bay, the American variety was not. And that's the danger of invasive plants, which I talk a lot about in this book. They have the power to destroy our ecosystems. Same with invasive pests. We're seeing all kinds of emerald ash borer right now is a really big hot topic in the Eastern Seaboard. Every region of the country, you know, you've got something invasive that's probably destroying an ecosystem. And that's really scary. In the case of the American chestnut, you're exactly right. Luckily, there was some genetic variation. So some of the chestnuts were able to survive. But we still have some growing now. They die young, but at least they're still alive. So if you had an American chestnut that were genetically identical, none would survive. So you've illustrated the perfect point there, which is genetic variation really matters in the face of change.
I wanted to ask you kind of to discuss a little bit of the differences. So we have had people on the show pretty recently too as well that have been doing Miyawaki planting projects. Yeah. I'd like you to kind of do a comparison between Project Pando methods of growing in, because I think each has their own place and strengths. And I think it's wonderful for you to kind of draw a contrast there and really express the uniqueness of what you're doing with Project Pando.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I'll use this opportunity to sort of lay out the rest of the book. So after in the opening sections, I give the reader these fun essays about how the planet works and then not so fun essays about how we're destroying those systems. I really get into the meat and potatoes of the book. And that's what it's meant to be. It's a hands-on book that you can use in your yard or at your community gathering space. And that's, to me, really what I love about the book is it's empowering. I don't leave the reader in the lurch on why things are terrible. We move on to, okay, and here's some stuff we can do. So what I do is I essentially, section three is called Easy Ways You Can Help Heal Earth. It's just the easiest things you can do in your yard that are just either take no time at all, or they're going to save you time in some cases. It's things like, why, you know, saving a tree, not cutting it down, can save you money, save you time, and do good because you saved that tree. And I basically talk about the many reasons why people remove trees that are often founded on fear. So my goal with this chapter is dispel those fears. And then I also give the reader sort of a way to do a basic assessment of their tree. Also in this section, I talk about things like planting saplings. We'll come back to pocket forest in 1 second. And I try to explain why planting a little baby 1 or 2 year old sapling is actually a lot better than planting a big tree you would buy from the nursery. You can plant 25 saplings in an hour easily, and they generally live longer, healthier lives. They have lower mortality. So there's all these reasons why, you know, go plant a sapling. It'll take you 3 minutes. Talk about saving food scraps and green waste. Talk about why fertilizers are actually so damaging and why you'd be better doing nothing or just easy, easy, easy ways to make your own compost that's just better. So that's sort of section three, the really easy stuff. I get to section four, and this is where I start talking about a little bit more complicated things, just two specifically. One, I teach the reader how to get rid of grass in favor of a native grass and flower ecosystem called a meadow or whatever, you know, some people call them prairies. And then I also talk about what's called a pocket forest, which is similar to Miyawaki, but not quite the same. I'm going to come right back around this and just end by saying the final section, which we've already talked about, is the Project Pando model. I call this more complicated ways to help heal Earth and, you know, and while engaging your community. So I try to stage it from easiest to hardest. So section four, the pocket forest is very similar to Miyawaki. They are a little different. I'll sort of walk through both. Both are founded on this idea that it's better to plant stuff in high, like putting a lot of trees near each other. Sort of if you were to look at your average street tree planting, you'd see one tree planted by itself and then, you know, 100 feet later, one more. This is the idea that by planting lots of trees near each other, they're going to do better together. I don't want to get too technical on some of Miyawaki's other underpinnings, but essentially that's both of them hinge on that idea. With Miyawaki, there's a lot of time invested in soil preparation and there's a lot of time invested in maintenance. And I applaud that. I love it. I think it's great. The problem is that for most projects in the suburban space or municipality level, they're not feasible from a cost standpoint. The kind of soil preparation at Miyawaki requires and the maintenance is well beyond the scope of any municipality or HOA or homeowner. So what a pocket forest is sort of a different way of doing this same idea. It's less emphasis on soil preparation. So I basically, it's less emphasis on maintenance. Maybe survivability is not quite as good and we can get into the details. I'll talk about that next, but you end up with the same outcome. So I'll just sort of walk through the basic process on how a pocket forest works, and then I'll tie it back to Project Panda. So the pocket forest, we lay down cardboard and wood chips and let it sit for 4 to 6 months and just rot. It's a great way to do weed control. It's a great way to get your bed, quote unquote, prepped, because everything's gonna be nice and mushy by the time you go and plant. And that is soil preparation right there. Then the next step is buy native saplings or grow them yourself through Project Panda. That's sort of the tie-in there. And then you plant them about 2 to 3 feet apart. You want to use lots of different species, native trees that are big, native trees that are little, native shrubs, you name it. Just have fun. Get a lot of native stuff in there. You know, we could get really technical and try to recreate an ecosystem. We've done that. But in the interest of just keeping this fun and doable for the average person, I always just recommend get a bunch of your favorite species and put them in there. I mean, we can do technical ecosystem restoration stuff later and get really specific. Then mark each tree with a yellow or orange driveway marker. This will be very important because in the following years, it'll take about maybe 2 to 3 growing seasons. Once a month, we'll go through, not once a month during the whole year, but once a month during the growing season, we'll go through that little pocket forest and we'll pull out anything that's a tree that's not marked with an orange driveway marker. So this makes it very easy for folks who aren't very good at plant ID. And we don't have to worry about herbaceous weeds. That doesn't matter. The trees will grow and shade all that out. All we really have to worry about is invasive trees. That's the main thing. So, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, I could give you some times, but like here at my house, I have It's about 4,000 square feet of pocket forest. And I mean, I'm done now. I don't have to do any maintenance because they're graduated. But during their early growing seasons, I invested maybe a grand total of 8 hours for an entire year. Just really negligible stuff. So it's really cool because had I done those 4,000 square feet using traditional planting methods, you know, one tree spaced apart, I'd be doing a lot more work maintaining the bed, pulling weeds. I'd have to do that forever because that's just open space. Nature wants to fill space. So I'd be fighting an uphill battle forever. So what I love is that I didn't really spend any more time or money planting my pocket forest than I would have doing a traditional approach. And in exchange, I get this huge mega diversity. Lots of different birds are coming in for the different plants. And I'm seeing insects I've never seen before. It's just a really lovely space. And the best part is now I do zero maintenance. That's not totally fair. I do have to do some pruning. But any tree in the suburban space, you're going to have to do some pruning just along the edges.
This type of pocket forest is growing a little bit faster, kind of like a Miyawaki forest would?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Same concept. I mean, it really is very similar. It's about the tactics are different. And, you know, both just tap into this is sort of a key point I make in the book. We can look at natural ecosystems for guidance. That is the key to all of this. And if you go walking out in any field, you're going to see trees growing up and they're growing close to one another. And if you go to a young forest that's not been overpredated by deer, you're going to find the trees are so close to each other, you almost can't even get out or get through. As the trees grow larger and larger, some win and some die out. The ones that die out make space then for these new entries that are the understory trees and then that are the shrub layers. So essentially, over time, every pocket of a North American forest or a South American jungle is loaded with plants. That's how nature operates. It really wants to maximize every single space to produce as much life as possible. And both of these systems tap into that basic principle. It's also, yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off on a rabbit hole here, but yeah, that's the short of it is these are based on how nature actually works.
And so in your Project Pando model, you have a lot of local volunteers that are collecting the seeds from various varieties of natives, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. And did you find that you needed to do some instruction or like you have videos teaching people how to collect or how to store, et cetera?
It's a great question. A big part of our work is building training and support documents, teaching people how to identify trees and seeds, and if they want to process them, how to do that. So we have to put in just a tremendous amount of time into that part of it. I'd say that's really at this point the biggest work that we do, because we're always trying to expand the database. We're also getting people interested from other areas, and we're hosting everything on Google Drive for now so that they can add their work from their area. I would say if people continue to join from other regions, we might have to think about how to host all that information. It might be like a wiki or something. I don't know exactly what that looks like, but right now it's a Google Drive architecture and lots of training that go into that. We also do videos on YouTube. So we have the Leaf and Limb channel is where most of our videos are. There is a Project Pando YouTube. We don't post as much there as we do on the Leaf and Limb side. And we actually, so we have videos on how to plant saplings, how to plant pocket forests, things like that, because some folks take the trees from Pando, sort of as I alluded to earlier, and they go and install pocket forests. So that's one of the really fun applications with Project Pando is you can grow trees and then use those trees to make pocket forests.
So if I've heard you correctly, you are working with a number of people from surrounding, well, maybe not surrounding areas, but other cities. And would you say most of them are on the East Coast kind of generally, or they're kind of sprinkled all across the country?
I would say when I say spreading, I mean like adjacent counties. There are a few. I want to say, let's see, just off the top of my head, there's one group in New Orleans, one group in Maryland, and I know there's one more in the Northeast, so not many outside of where we are. It's more the spread is sort of like North Carolina, I'd say, the sort of a county level.
Okay, great. So one of the things that I wanted to just note in my just kind of observations of some of the research that's out there is that air pruning beds, from my understanding, are not being used necessarily in the nursery industry, and they tend to use, you know, like cells and things like that that are kind of encouraging a very long taproot and not some of the benefits that you would get from an air pruning bed. But one of the things that I think was interesting to note is that if you're going to, let's say, plant 300 or 400 trees within an air pruning bed, they're all growing together. And so when you go to harvest them and remove them and plant them somewhere, that it was brought up that it's really best to do that in a very cold season so that it's not as shocking to the tree And did you want to maybe?
Yeah, it's a good point. In terms of plant life and most life, there's really two seasons. There's a dormant season and an active season. And you're exactly right. It is best to, we would only want to take those trees out during the dormant season, which for most of us here in North America, that's winter. Could be late fall. It just depends on where you are. The dormant season, the leaves will have fallen off if it's a deciduous tree. And that is absolutely the best time to take them out. It's also the best time to get them in the ground. We encourage anybody who uses air pruning methodologies, as soon as you take them out, if you can plant them, great. If they need to stay out, fine, but try to minimize that time. And all of that takes place in the dormant season.
So do you find that because you're doing the method of, you know, cardboard and mulch and things like that, do you find that the ground is a little bit less frozen than, let's say, the ground that just is kind of exposed to the elements more?
You know, one thing is, I live in North Carolina, and I will say I can't remember the last time we had frozen ground. We barely have winters anymore. So I think it's a little different here. But what I do notice is that even just after 4 to 6 months of cardboard and 6 or 8 inches of wood chips laying there, already I see signs that the soil is beginning to rehabilitate. I already see life coming in to that area. So that's very encouraging. And it's also great for new plants. And I'll add, plants terraform soil as well. So they, when a plant pulls energy from the sun, some of that food that it produces goes to itself, but some of the food it produces, it pushes out through its root system for life in the soil. So not only are we're hitting it kind of from both sides. On the one side, we've got the wood chips and the cardboard. Then we put all these plants in, and there's a ton of them, and they get to work taking sun energy and making sugars in their roots. And man, it's shocking how fast an area will return to good health. Even in some of the worst, that I have one planting that comes to mind right away, planted in just some of the worst conditions you can imagine. It's the sort of soil that actually smells bad. You know it's bad when that's the case. And it had a high mortality, about 30%, which seems like a lot, but it almost doesn't, you almost wouldn't even know looking at it. There's still so many more plants there that it's been just fine. So now here we are, I want to say maybe 3 or 4 years later, and it's just the ground it's mind-boggling how healthy it is now compared to what it was.
That's awesome. So do you try to suggest like how long to leave the soil dormant if you're going to be using the cardboard and mulch, like a certain number of months or weeks or?
Yeah, in a perfect world, I'm speaking a little bit from North Carolina standards here, but let's say we wanted to plant it in our dormant season in say January, which here, if you're up north, that's going to be too cold with frozen ground. So you're probably going to need to be planting either at the beginning of the dormant season or at the end of the dormant season. So your timing is going to be different, but let's just use January. We would want to be putting our cardboard and wood chips in place around July would be ideal. And that gives lots of time for that to, so first, it's going to kill all the herbaceous weeds or whatever is growing there, July, August, September. And then we're going to start tapering off into October, November, when it's getting cooler and rainier. So it's going to get even mushier. And by the time you go to plant in January, you've got reasonably ideal planting conditions.
Yeah, that's excellent. So you're removing the cardboard or you're cutting through it when you're going to do this?
Yeah, at this point in time, it's so mushy that your shovel has, you may not even see the cardboard anymore pending the site. But if it is there, it's going to be very mushy and easy to punch through. Gotcha. And the key is, and of course, get a bunch of fun native plants that you love. Have different types of trees and shrubs. But the really crucial thing is markers. Some kind of, and I'm talking about driveway markers or these orange or yellow ones. It doesn't have to be that. It could be bamboo marker, stakes, or could even use the little landscape flags that you see around. They're not as good. Whatever it is, ideally would be durable for at least 3 years. And I know some people might hesitate on the driveway markers because they're plastic, but they're reusable. So what we do is we just cycle them around to different site. So maybe you get the driveway markers and then give them to a friend in 3 years to do it so they can do a pocket forest.
Yeah, excellent. So I know in the Miyawaki method, they suggest watering for maybe 2 to 3 years. And I was reading in your book that you're not really kind of putting the emphasis on that. I would imagine, you know, if somebody did want to maybe increase the survivability percentage of the trees and plants you've planted, maybe they could do that, especially if they already have existing water systems set up in the area. How do you feel about that?
I'm a little mixed on my feelings about that. I will say that it can never hurt to give a little water to a young tree. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. It needs it. But I hesitate to make them reliant on the water. I'm sort of the opinion that your trees should be able to survive. Now, maybe I'm just speaking from a place of always being limited on time and money. You know, projects are always less time and money than you want. So I suppose that on a personal basis, especially if it's a pocket forest and you do have that water infrastructure already, might as well do some watering, absolutely. But to those who can't do it, maybe due to lack of time, it's fine. You don't have to. There will be mortality, and that's okay. Like I said, the highest I've ever seen, and what is not, and I told you about the soil being so bad. I didn't mention also that it was a western facing sun, which here in this area, North Carolina, I mean, it is soul crushing. It is just as bad a place to be for a sapling as you can imagine. And we had 30% mortality. It's just really nothing. In this particular area, there's about 220 trees planted in this small postage stamp front yard. And when it was all said and done, there was around 160 or so trees still in this postage stamp. I mean, you look at it now and you would never have known that some of the trees didn't make it. It's perfectly dense. So I think watering, great if you can do it. Don't go too long because you don't want your trees to like require watering. Then that's a problem. And if you can't do it, that's totally fine. And I think that's part of where our maintenance is just where the approach is a little easier. And to be fair, more will die, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you still have, you know, with such density in planting, you've still got the kind of survival of the fittest in a way, I guess.
Yeah. And this is another, now I know we're talking to the person who can actually do the Pando methodology, but if you end up growing your own trees, then you're actually starting with very resilient saplings. The way the air pruning methodology works, and especially if you follow how we do it at Project Pando, it doesn't give those young trees really any support. Little bit of watering maybe in the hottest of times, but again, this is a good thing. This means that, and they're grown outdoors in the natural element, so even before your young sapling is put in the ground, it already has a really good sense for what life is going to be like, and it's already survived reasonably tough times. So it is a good thing to push your trees a little bit and make them work to survive.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I really liked what you did with the book in terms of additional add-ons that you've already alluded to a little bit with QR codes, and that was a great idea. What was your experience of writing the book in general? And
yeah, it was tons of fun in the first part. I just loved it. I had so much fun. I was like Saturday morning, which is one of my big writing blocks, Saturday and Sunday mornings, I get up early and write, and that was just always such a joy until I got to the editing phase. And the editing phase was most unpleasant. It's the most fun thing that I'll never want to do again is probably the best way to describe the book. But it really, in the end, I'm so glad it's there. I'm so glad I was able to get these ideas on paper. I really do hope that I can bring sort of a new segment into this work, one that I think has been sort of prohibited by lack of time and money. And I think if we're going to move things forward, I don't know how it is with your circles, but I know here a lot of times I'm speaking to the same people about trees because it's the same group of us who really care about them. And I'd love to see that group expand.
So yeah, so you've mentioned Louisiana. That's not super close to where you are in Maryland. And so it's good that it is expanding. And I think of course, you know, the natives are going to look different. Where I am in Nevada, I mean, you're not going to see a huge number of trees throughout the desert shrubby area, but I think there's always a lot to learn about the natives that we have growing in any area. I think you had some great resources in the book, like using iNaturalist and other methods to kind of, for people that aren't familiar with natives, on how to familiarize themselves with, you know, the basic trees and then the more nuances of different natives to the area. Did you want to maybe explain a little?
Yeah, that's a good point. I sort of, when we're talking about pocket forests, I said, just go buy some favorites. I think there's groups of people who maybe don't even know the first thing about native trees. And to those I say, find either a local native nursery or an online and ask for recommendations. Like, that is your easiest entry. But then I offer some strategies for how you might learn a little more. Most states have a North Carolina Native Society. They're going to have ID guides for natives. There's probably garden clubs in your area who love natives and can either teach you how to identify them or give you resources. There are often arboretums and botanical centers. There's all these ways that we can begin to learn these things while doing fun things. Our arboretum is very beautiful here. So it's a double win. It's beautiful and I get to learn new species. So, and then I also layer in a little bit of technology like iNaturalist. I think it's just really great. A little bit of a learning curve. I always recommend that people go watch a tutorial because it can be frustrating at first, but really easy once you just get a few instructions under your belt. And with that information, you can, the other thing I always tell people is when you're learning native trees or any species, the first 10 are the hardest. And then it starts to get easier because you realize there's these patterns to how you do identification. And once you start to get the hang of the patterns, I mean, you can quickly add a bunch more under your belt. It's a skill that definitely builds on itself. And it's really fun because you'll have these encounters like I had yesterday, for example. I was walking. We have a local area. Instead, it's a forest, but it's sort of it's in the heart of town. A lot of people go there. And I noticed lots and lots and lots of people walking past Maypop. And it's very rare in this area, in this Umstead area, because it's overpredated by deer. Maypop is this beautiful little ephemeral that comes up, and it's only up for maybe a week or two. All these people, so I was sitting near the area, lots of people walking by, nobody really even noticed it. I was thinking, man, it's crazy that nobody even notices that plant that you would so rarely see in this area. And I think that's one of the joys of ID, is you get to see those things. You're like, oh, that's cool. That's rare, or that's an unusual plant, or that's an interesting plant for X, Y, and Z.
I would imagine it's kind of, you know, becoming more aware of the web of life as well. Like in the previous interview you brought up, is just, and I think not everybody knows that. And I think the people that do understand it, like yourself and others that understand the intricacy of how many more, you know, animal species, insects and things are supported by native species than, let's say, you know, a tree that came from Asia or yeah. So maybe you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. The difference is crazy. So essentially a tree from this area that's co-evolved with life here, it is a hub of, it's everything. It's food, it's shelter. Doug Tallamy has written a lot about the extent to which oaks provide for so many different kinds of life. I mean, he lists just hundreds of different kinds of leafhoppers and hundreds of different moths. And I mean, his list, which is only a portion of what is, we only know a little bit about oaks to be, you know, it's not like we fully understand any of this. So the little bit that we know that that white oak supports 1,000 different species of insects, which, think about all the birds and the possums and the raccoons and everything else that rely on those insects as well. And that's just one little chunk of the web. We can go in lots of different directions. You can sort of zoom down to a moss level where Robin Wall Kimmerer has done some amazing work around what just a handful of moss has in it. It's again, an entire ecosystem in a handful of moss. She writes about how if you were walking, if you could just shrink yourself down and you walked in a handful of moss, you would think you were in a forest. And it's very much like that. There's predators and there's prey and there's insects, you know, in air quotes here, because we're at a microscopic level. So it's just really cool. And then you can go to the root zone. I mean, we know next to nothing about life in the soil. We didn't even know that mycorrhizal fungi was a thing until the 90s. Like, that's just crazy to me. We're learning new things every year. We're learning about something called rhizophagy now, which is this crazy complex thing that bacteria do in the root system. So there's just another huge hub of life in the root system. And we see that at every level. And that happens because that white oak has been co-evolving with all this, these other species across hundreds of thousands and millions of years in this area. And we look at, say, a sawtooth oak, it's done the same in China. Then you bring a sawtooth oak here, which is a common street tree here in Raleigh. The sawtooth oak really doesn't feed anything, because if a caterpillar comes up to that oak and tries to take a bite of the leaves, it will be harmed. A tree doesn't want to be eaten. They defend themselves. They use all kinds of chemicals in their leaves and other strategies to not be eaten, much like anything in the world, it doesn't want to be eaten. So nothing's overcome that defense yet. It would take another 100,000 years or whatever the number looks like for the caterpillars here in Raleigh to be able to overcome the oak's defense and begin building this food web with the oak. And until that happens, it's essentially really not providing much in the landscape, except for it is providing carbon sequestration. So we can't overlook that. It's important. But it'd be better if we could have that carbon sequestration in addition to all this other life.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between planting a tree that's from here, which we call a native species, or a tree that's from another ecosystem, which we would call non-native, and in some cases, invasive, meaning it's causing harm.
Yeah. So what challenges have you come across in Project Pando local work that maybe would be helpful for others to understand who might be wanting to take on a project like this? And maybe what have you learned that might be helpful?
Well, the biggest first challenge was finding space. So to that end, we're fortunate that a land conservancy gave us space. My recommendation there would be talk to your local municipality and talk to your local nonprofits about who might have some space you can share. One of the next big challenges we hit was what would be the appropriate substrate in which to grow? Because if you think about a lot of the, like, say, potting soils, there's so many issues with how they're produced that it's would almost be causing more harm than good. And then dirt and soil, where do you get healthy? There's all these problems. And where we finally ended up was we tap into our municipality's yard leaf collection. So they here every fall, our city goes and picks up leaves from the curb. And then they have this giant mountain of leaves that they don't even know what to do with. The whole thing's absurd, by the way, but whatever. What we do is we take those leaves from them. They bring us dump truck loads for free, which is fantastic. And these rotting leaves are what we use to fill our air printing boxes. So that was, I'd say to anybody that has a municipality that does these leaf collection services, or even just landscapers often do this, if you can find big piles of rotting leaves, it's great for growing. I would say another big challenge has been providing the support necessary to identify the tree. To that end, we've been making documents like I described, but we also do tree walks, and we try to do these fairly regularly. These are just simply where we invite folks to come join us and let's go walk around and learn how to identify trees. That has been so popular. People love that. I would definitely recommend, if you know your tree ID even decently, share it with your community. People love it, and it's very helpful. It paves the way for being able to collect seeds. And then finally, just giveaways are always challenging. That's If you're an event planner, you're going to love planning a giveaway. If you're not an event planner, it's a lot of logistics. You know, where do the cars go? How to give away the tree? So that was a challenge. I think we've gotten better at that now. But that's just, you know, that's event planning right there.
I think Planted Forward, is that the organization?
Yeah. We still partner with them and do a lot of seed collection and giveaways and things like that. We just had a Arbor Day event last Friday that they put on, and it was really fantastic.
Yeah, I love the idea that they did one of the giveaways, I think, in front of the museum or something like that. So it's excellent.
Yeah, Maggie's been building We Planted Forward quite a bit. They're growing and doing really exciting things. Probably, I know y'all know each other, and I think there's probably been a lot of changes over the last year or two that are really exciting.
Excellent. Yeah, I haven't talked to her in a little while. Yeah, so besides from that aspect, have you decided or are you holding classes on helping people to understand like how to do the propagation? Are you doing most of the propagation yourselves as a nonprofit, or are you also teaching volunteers to have them kind of do the air pruning beds from their homes as well? How are you?
It's sort of all of the above. I think right now we're sort of in an interesting phase where now our next big challenge is money. Leaf and Limb funds Project Panda, but Leaf and Limb's reached its sort of its limit on what it can fund. So now we're thinking about fundraising because we need more people to do these sorts of things. Really, the classes especially. We'd love to be able to offer just way more classes about tree identification, how to grow seeds, how to process seeds, you name it, all parts of this operation. So part of the reason for this book, so one of the things I should mention, I'm not charging any money for the book. The book is free. Ebook is fully free, and the hard copy is just the cost of printing and shipping. And it really is meant to be free. But we do tell the reader, if you found value in the book and if you want to help support this sort of a thing, here's an you can donate money to Project Pando. And hoping that maybe some people will want to donate, maybe get some funds through that methodology. Don't know. We're also looking at some grants. The grants are interesting for us because there's a lot of grants in the tree space, but not necessarily exactly what we're doing. It's such a unique part of this work. So we're also looking at partnerships. Right now we're talking to another local municipality about maybe joining on a grant that they received. So if we can get more money, then we do want to do far more programming. That is sort of, we're just stuck on the money piece right now.
Right. Okay. And as we wrap up a little bit, I always like to touch on some of the rewards that you're enjoying of the work that you're doing. And I think you've touched on it a little bit, but maybe can you touch on that a little bit as well?
Yeah. I'd say the rewards are watching things grow. I really love, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a tree or a flower. It could be an idea or an organization or a movement. I think especially since the last time we spoke, it's just been really fun to see things growing. Ideas are taking off. I should say taking off, that's a big word, but they're at least growing. And more people are interested in native plants or in planting trees or in everything we've talked about today. I like being a part of that. I also just really sort of at the end of the day, love hanging out in a pocket forest or in a meadow and watching the insect life and seeing it's just a vibrant place. There's a lot happening. I think that's so interesting. So yeah, I think for me, it's the growing aspect. I just really enjoy that.
Excellent. Excellent. Actually, I did want to ask about that. So if you're working with municipalities, have you been planting some of the pocket forests in public areas?
So we actually just got our first city partnership on that. It's been a little bit of a slow push. We're finding that some of the local municipalities are a bit hesitant to do this, but there's a little city just outside of Raleigh called Morrisville. And we did a bunch of plantings for them recently as a showcase in their city. We'd like to do showcases in all the cities. I think it's gaining some popularity here. It's still kind of cutting edge. We are talking to NCDOT also about sort of rethinking what those exit ramps look like. Rather than doing rows of pines, maybe we load up exit ramps with diverse pocket forests. So there's a few exciting bits of movement, but these are new ideas, and new ideas always just move slowly.
Yeah. And now it was brought up, this, I think it was a Miyawaki Forest project in Boston, and they have groups of volunteers that over the span of time kind of, I don't know if it's like maybe once a month they're going in just to kind of, you know, pull out any invasive species or, you know, just to kind of touch base with them. Do you anticipate doing something like that with Project Pando, kind of organizing volunteers or with some other organizations that you're working with, such as Plant It Forward?
Yeah, absolutely. That is absolutely something we want to do. And actually, we already have some Pando pocket forests that volunteers help maintain. One is getting to be quite beautiful. So we do some of that, and we'd love to do a lot more of that. And maybe long-term, it would also include not just the pocket forest, but also the meadows, which is the exact same concept, but just on a grass and flower level. And everything we've talked about can be applied to that, from the seed collection in the wild to the growing your own plant, all of it applies. So I think in the long run, if funding were there, Pando, we would love to just put pocket forests and meadows all over town and have just bring community in to help care for that. I think it would be such a special thing.
I think for more reasons than one, you brought in just the aspect of it's beautiful and it's supporting biodiversity, and it's also really supporting a healthier climate. And so there's reasons for that.
Yeah, we have a lot of open green space here in Raleigh that's just either not being used or generally just being mowed, honestly. A lot of it just gets mowed. So there's a lot of opportunity to do that. And the beautiful thing is, if we did, and if we could engage the local community, it would be a multiple good effects, connecting people with trees, also connecting people with each other. I think there's value to that. And then there's all of the health benefits and the psychological well-being benefits that come from working with plants and working with soil.
Yeah, it also, I'm aware that there's areas where there's deforestation going on in the area, maybe not directly in Raleigh, but of course, that's an issue in itself that's very challenging. But I know the Forest Service, you know, is trying to go back and plant saplings, but in a lot of cases, they don't always survive. And it seems like this method of planting, what you're doing, is maybe kind of an in-between stage of like what they're doing. And then the very other end of the spectrum, which is a Miyawaki forest, which, like you've alluded to, can be very expensive and time consuming. And so maybe we need some kind of blending in between, as well as trying to leave mother trees and some of the, you know, the amazing abilities that mother trees have to, you know, to feed and send energy to areas. So
yeah, there's an interesting I've been reading some research about something called applied nucleation, and it's basically a pocket forest or a Miyawaki forest. And the idea is that instead of reforesting an entire many hundreds of acres forest, maybe you put one, I'm going to just use pocket forest, but just a high density planting. It could be whatever style, doesn't matter. A high density planting at the core of, say, an acre or 2 acres. And you give that core some protection from the deer, and you let it mature, and then peel away the fencing or whatever that looks like and let it start to move out naturally. So there's some great research to show that that might be a better way to do reforestation. So it's interesting that you mentioned that, because perhaps there's a future for these planting approaches in the reforestation efforts. And I'll also go back to one other thing you mentioned. You said perhaps you haven't had deforestation in Raleigh, maybe not in the traditional sense with loggers and whatnot, but I will say in the past decade, we've just had a report come out that just here in Wake County, which is just one county, we've had 11,000 acres of woods cut for development. And that's happening all over North Carolina. And I guarantee you, we're not the only state where this is happening. So deforestation does happen in the cities, just like it does out in the wilds. And quite frankly, both are tragic in their own separate ways.
Yeah, my understanding is that a lot of the trees that are being cut down in terms of forests are being used to create wood pellets, that the UK is purchasing a lot of those,
Yeah.
kind of being framed as a sustainable form of energy. But, you know, I think you and I could probably agree that that's not really sustainable.
No, yeah, biofuels have been a big thing here in North Carolina. And we could, yeah, it's not sustainable.
So you have shared about how we can get, where do you send?
The book is located at leaflimb.com/wonder. If you go to leaflimb.com, you can't miss it. But again, it's leaflimb or www.leaflimb, like a leaf on a tree, limb on a tree.com/wonder. And right now it's the only place we're offering the book, like I said, free for digital and cost of printing and shipping for the hard copy. Maybe we'll offer it on other platforms in the future, but for now, that's where it's located.
Excellent. Excellent. And just one last question. If your ideas, your experience, and your wisdom were all wrapped up in seeds of potential action for you to give to others, what advice would you give to someone kind of like yourself that is going to be a seed planted in their area to kind of grow these ideas and expand upon them? What advice would you give to that person?
Just go for it and do something. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be a whole full-time job. Like, just start somewhere. It's really important. I think the doing is often the hardest part. And the cool thing is if you start doing it, it'll open up a road in front of you that maybe you could have never seen.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us and really for your dedication and work on it. That is really a solution in so many ways, just bringing beauty and bringing people to nature and really helping to regenerate our earth and our ecosystems. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you haven't yet visited your local Green Online Hub, then please visit gogreenlocally.org and check out the directories for events, groups, businesses, online resources, and local support listings for your area.